Lecture 5, Karl Marx and Socialism.
We've been following the intellectual trajectory of the classical economists and the sort of broad set of views they held in common. Their broad sense of how markets worked with selfish people accumulating and trading. The importance they placed on free trade or freer trade between countries. The notion that they were sort of building toward a supply and demand model of prices and of value. And perhaps most of all, their sense that there was something natural in the world, something natural driving us toward a certain kind of harmony. Now, with John Stuart Mill, those things are beginning to break down a little bit, particularly the sense of harmony. But I think what really broke the classical school in the middle of the 19th century is the force of the Industrial Revolution. This episode in British history, essentially you can think of as the building of many, many factories for many, many new kinds of manufacturing. Those factories are drawing people in from the countrysides and bringing them into the countrysides into what conditions that were often abysmal. That was changing the social structures of both the city and the country, and it was putting people in just very dreadful working conditions. One of the most powerful parts of Karl Marx's critique of capitalism is his raw descriptions in his book on capital of what working conditions were like at the time for people in a number of different industries. Let me give you a couple of examples taken from the pages of Marx's Capital. He quotes a county magistrate in 1860 describing the lice trade. There was an amount of privation and suffering among that portion of the population connected with the lace trade, unknown in other parts of the kingdom, indeed in the civilized world. Children of 9 or 10 years are dragged from their squalid beds at 2, 3, or 4 o'clock in the morning and compelled to work for a bare subsistence until 10, 11, or 12 at night. Their limbs wearing away, their frames dwindling, their faces whitening, their humanity absolutely sinking into a stone-like torpor, utterly horrible to contemplate. The system is one of unmitigated slavery, socially, physically, morally, and spiritually. What can be thought of a town which holds a public meeting to petition that the period of labor for men shall be diminished to 18 hours a day? We declaim against the Virginian and Carolinian cotton planters. Is their black market, their lash, their barter of human flesh more detestable than this slow sacrifice of humanity, which takes place that veils and collars may be fabricated for the benefit of capitalists? He goes on to write about potters, the potters in the towns of Staffordshire, from a report of commissioners in that district. Quote, the report says, "The potters as a class, both men and women, represent a degenerated population, both physically and morally. They are, as a rule, stunted in growth, ill-shaped, frequently ill-formed in the chest. They become prematurely old and are certainly short-lived. They are phlegmatic and bloodless and exhibit their debility of constitution by obstinate attacks of dyspepsia, disorders of the liver and kidneys, and by rheumatism. But of all diseases, they are especially prone to chest disease, to pneumonia, bronchitis, and asthma." He wrote about the manufacture of Lucifer matches and how using phosphorus in those matches poisoned the workers slowly. Since the discovery of applying phosphorus to the match itself, it has spread the form of lockjaw, which a Vienna physician in 1845 discovered to be a disease peculiar to Lucifer matchmakers. Half the workers are children under 13 and young persons under 18. The manufacture is on account of its unhealthiness and unpleasantness in such bad odor that only the most miserable part of the laboring class, half-starved widows and so forth, deliver up their children to it, the ragged, half-starved, untaught children. Dante would have found the worst horrors of his inferno surpassed in this manufacture. Story after story after story, all stomach-turning, all wrenching, all extraordinarily difficult. You can multiply these stories hundreds of times. If you want to read the works of Charles Dickens in a book like Hard Times, you can read that as journalism in some ways that tells you a lot about what conditions really were like at the time. How do people react to this level of human suffering? There are several different responses that are possible. One set of responses we could categorize as being what we'd call utopian socialists. Utopian socialists believed that if we just gave up capitalism and acquisitiveness and put ourselves into a better social structure, all of this would pass and we would be better off. Names of people like Robert Owen or Charles Fourier or the Count Henri de Saint-Simon, they all proposed giving up private property, having people stop being so acquisitive, and stepping away from these work conditions in that way. They often set up really detailed plans for planning all of people's lives to make sure that they would do this properly. The problem with those is their lack of realism. As Malthus said, they are in some sense like talking about what if people became ostriches. It's not useful to talk about that. In a quiet way, Mill was sort of what you might call a practical socialist. He was willing to consider all kinds of social reforms, but he believed that in the end, you had to have the force of competition in the market to work. A final response is from scientific socialists. Now, scientific socialists, of whom Karl Marx is the first and the most preeminent, agreed with the moral critique of capitalism. They strongly agreed with it. They strongly agreed with all of these feelings. But to them, the point was not morality. In fact, morality should be set aside and ignored. Instead, what they wanted to argue was that, scientifically speaking, capitalism was doomed. The emphasis on scientifically speaking. And so their argument was not about injustice, or they would not have liked to think of it that way. They wanted to think about it as in terms of whether you like my point of view or not, whether you agree with my moral claim or not. I want to say that, scientifically speaking, this system of capitalism is doomed. Now, before discussing Karl Marx's economic theories, let's first just talk a little bit about his life. He was born in Prussia to a Jewish family that converted to Protestantism when he was a child. Apparently, they converted in order to help the business of his father, who was a lawyer. He studied law, history, philosophy at various universities in Germany. At 25, he married a woman named Jenny van Westphalen, who was the daughter of a baron in Germany. So he married into noble ranks. Because of his radicalism and the fact that he kept calling for the overthrow of society, he was exiled from Germany, where he went to Paris. And there he met Friedrich Engels. You may have heard of Marx and Engels working together. Engels was a good historian and philosopher in his own right. He was also from a rich family, and during most of his life he was able to support Marx financially. He was eventually exiled from Paris, again for radicalism, went to Brussels, where he wrote the Manifesto of the Communist Party, which we now just call the Communist Manifesto, in 1848. And eventually he was exiled from Brussels as well, and went to London, and lived the rest of his life there, largely in the British Museum. The story is that every day he went to the British Museum, the library, at 10 o'clock, and was there till 7 every night, reading and writing away. He saw himself as a direct intellectual descendant of Adam Smith, and particularly of David Ricardo, and he saw himself as building upon their work and just taking it the next step. Marx did not see himself as someone who was opposed to them, but merely as someone who was going beyond them and building the next stage of theory. In 1867, he published Das Kapital, Capital, his great work. And volumes 2 and 3 were published after his death by Friedrich Engels. There's another long set of volumes of Marx's writing that were sort of collected and published posthumously as well. So when you think of Marx as a scholar and a person, how do you think of him? Well, I always kind of think of him sitting in the library, kind of a walking stereotype of a Germanic scholar, with a full beard, pedantic, painstaking, reading everything, disagreeing with everything, really upset at everyone who'd made all these terrible mistakes, persuaded he was the only one who knew how to see the world. He could really be a rotten guy. And he could be insulting, paranoid, quarrelsome, suspicious. He was lousy at dealing with disagreement or anyone who felt differently. Anyone who deviated from his point of view, he would call them ethnic slurs and worse. He may not have been an anti-Semite at heart, but he was certainly willing to toss around vicious names with the best of them. You think about really nice people like Malthus and Ricardo and Smith, and you sort of think Marx, by comparison, was just not such a nice guy. It's enough to make you wonder sometimes if all this talk about the international brotherhood of man doesn't somehow make people grumpy. All through his life, Marx was sick. He was usually poor. He lived in two rooms a lot of his life. He was a loving husband and father by all accounts, but he was writing newspaper articles and trying to live off his books, begging his friends for money from time to time. Does Marx deserve blame? In thinking about Marx, a lot of people have sort of a knee-jerk reaction, which is Marx created Stalin and Soviet totalitarianism. And so I'm not interested in Marx for that reason. It would almost be evil to be interested in Marx for that reason. We'll come back to this subject later, but it's worth mentioning it here because we should get it off the table and out in the open. Marx has a fearsome reputation, of course, but I personally think that blaming a little man who's writing pamphlets in the museum in the 1860s for Soviet totalitarianism in the 1930s is just a little bit of a stretch. It's no question that Marx may have been right or wrong. It's just a question of how much you blame anyone for the use which is made of their work long after their death. After all, if we're to blame Marx for the Soviet Union, then shouldn't we blame Adam Smith for the terrible evils of capitalism? If we're going to blame prophets of one system, why not blame prophets of the other system? My own sense is that you can be wrong, as I think Marx was often wrong, and you can be personally unpleasant, as I think he was often unpleasant, without needing to be Joseph Stalin. Yeah, the Soviet philosophers said he was their ancestor, but that doesn't make it his fault. It makes it their fault. When we think about Marx and economics, where do we start off with? Marx is trying to generate what he thought of as a capitalist law of motion, a law of motion for how capitalist society would work. Now, you remember that earlier, economics had sort of been generated out of the sense of trying to explain how the world worked. The tableau économique comes out of the circulation of blood in the body. Well, the new science of Marx's time is Darwin and thinking about evolution. And thinking about how things evolve into other things. Marx read Darwin, and in fact, another interesting link here is that Darwin actually wrote once that some of his ideas on natural selection came from Darwin reading Malthus about population and how population changes. So there are these links going from Malthus to Darwin to Marx and sort of great minds of the time thinking about similar subjects. So the starting point for thinking about how does the capitalist society work is to think about what are the important classes that we're thinking about. And in Marx's view, you could sort of start ignoring the landlords by about 1860. Feudalism is dead. Landlords aren't as important as they used to be. And instead, we can focus in on two groups, the bourgeoisie and the proletariat. A lot of Marx's basic thought is described very well in the Communist Manifesto. And I quote from that. The modern bourgeois society has sprouted from the ruins of feudal society. It has established new classes, new conditions of oppression, and new forms of struggle in the place of the old ones. Our epoch, the epoch of the bourgeoisie, possesses, however, this distinctive feature. It has simplified the class antagonisms. Society as a whole is more and more splitting up into two great hostile camps, into two great classes facing each other, bourgeoisie and proletariat. So we're going to organize the world and capitalist motion in terms of these two groups. What does the bourgeoisie do? When you think about Marx's view of the bourgeoisie, what you need to think about is two things that are going on. One is his extraordinary respect for the productive power of the bourgeoisie and how they were able to produce so much through these new institutions of capitalism. On the other hand, he thinks they're ruining everyone else's life. So as you listen to me quote from the Capitalist Manifesto, and I'll be skipping through a few passages, listen for those two themes running back and forth. The bourgeoisie historically has played a most revolutionary part. Wherever it has got the upper hand, it has put an end to all feudal, patriarchal, idyllic relations. It has pitilessly torn asunder the feudal ties that bound man to his natural superiors, and has left remaining no other nexus between man and man than naked self-interest, than callous cash payment. It has drowned the most heavenly ecstasies of religious fervor, of chivalrous enthusiasm, of Philistine sentimentalism in the icy water of egotistical calculation. It has resolved personal worth into exchange value, and in place of the numberless, indefeasible, chartered freedoms, has set up a single unconscionable freedom, free trade. In one word, for exploitation veiled by religious and political illusions, it has substituted naked, shameless, direct, brutal exploitation. The bourgeoisie has stripped of its halo every occupation hitherto honored and looked at with awe. It has converted the physician, the lawyer, the priest, the poet, the man of science into paid wage laborers. It has been the first to show what man's activity can bring about. The bourgeoisie has accomplished wonders far surpassing European pyramids, Roman aqueducts, and Gothic cathedrals. It has conducted expeditions that put in the shade all former exoduses of nations and crusades. The bourgeoisie, by the rapid improvement of all instruments of production, by the immensely facilitated means of communication, draws all, even the most barbarian nations, into civilization. The cheap prices of its commodities are the heavy artillery with which it batters down all Chinese walls, with which it forces the barbarians' intensely obstinate hatred of foreigners to capitulate. The bourgeoisie has created enormous cities, has greatly increased the urban population as compared with the rural, and has thus rescued a considerable part of the population from the idiocy of rural life. The bourgeoisie, during its rule of scarce 100 years, has created more massive and more colossal productive forces than have all preceding generations together. Subjection of nature's forces to man, machinery, application of chemistry to industry and agriculture, steam navigation, railways, electric telegraphs, clearing of whole continents for cultivation, canalization of rivers, whole populations conjured out of the ground. What earlier century had even a presentiment that such productive forces slumbered in the lap of social labor? So on the one hand, the bourgeoisie is ruining things. It's turning everything into cash payment. On the other hand, it's extraordinarily productive, revolutionizing how everything is carried out. Now, what's the process that's going to happen here as the bourgeoisie goes through this two-sided process? The key here is a labor theory of value. And the labor theory of value, remember, has all kinds of problems, but Marx basically swallows it whole. He takes the lines out of Ricardo in particular and some out of Smith, which say value comes from labor, and he says, this is my rock. This is what I'm going to base my whole theory on. The statement he has in mind is that labor provides value, and that you can think of labor kind of as a homogeneous group. So he writes, the labor time socially necessary to produce is that required to produce an article under the normal conditions of production and with the average degree of skill and intensity prevalent at the time. A use value or useful article has value only because human labor has been embodied or materialized in it. How is the magnitude of value to be measured? Plainly, by the quantity of the value-creating substance, the labor contained in the article. The quantity of labor is measured by its duration, weeks, days, hours. So value is going to come out of labor for Marx. Now remember, this is a highly controversial theory, and there's by no means clear that it's right. In fact, more strongly, I would say it's fairly clear that it's not right. But that's where Marx starts off. Now, what happens if you've got a labor theory of value? There's a link between the labor theory of value and the exploitation that the bourgeoisie does. Marx argues that workers must produce more than they're paid, because after all, they produce more than they're paid, and the extra is what goes to the capitalist. And that's why you hire workers, because they're going to produce more than they're paid. So, when you think about the battle between the bourgeoisie and the proletariat, the bourgeoisie is wanting the proletariat to work harder and harder and to pay them less and less and less, and to take more and more of that value for themselves. You can think of capital in that way, capitalism, as a vampire. As Marx puts it, capital is dead labor that vampire-like only lives by sucking living labor, and lives the more labor it sucks. The time during which the laborer works is the time during which the capitalist consumes the labor power he has purchased of him. So you can think of what laborers produce. A certain amount gets paid to them in wages, the rest goes to the capitalists who reinvest it. But Marx would argue that that labor theory of value means that the worker deserved all of it. All value came from labor. And so this surplus value, which is being taken by the capitalist, is exploited value. It's vampire-like sucking out of value in order to have more investment. Now, what's the implication of this kind of a dynamic? Where does this take us? Well, there are several implications that come out of Marxist-type thinking. One is, the rate of profit should be going down over time. Why is that? As more capital is used, and more capital is invested, you'll have plants which have, relatively speaking, more capital and less labor over time. After all, they keep sucking out more and more of surplus value and investing it. But remember, profit comes from exploiting labor. And if capital is becoming more and more important and labor is becoming less and less important, it'll have to be true that profit is dropping over time because there's less surplus labor to exploit, if you want to think of it in that way. Another way to think of it is you can get a lot of profit if you're exploiting 1,000 workers, but if you build machines and now you only need 100 workers, then you can only exploit 100 of them. So your profit's going to have to be lower than it was before. A second implication. This is going to lead to bigger and bigger companies, to a concentration of large companies and accumulation in wealth. The capitalists are just going to keep building up and building up and building up. Marx wrote, "Capitalist production only really begins when each individual capital employs simultaneously a large number of laborers, when consequently the labor process is carried on an extensive scale and yields relatively large quantities of products." The laws of this centralization of capital, or of the attraction of capital by capital, cannot be developed here. However, a few facts must suffice. The battle of competition is fought by cheapening commodities, that is, by making things cheaper and cheaper. The cheapness of commodities depends, other things equal, on the productiveness of labor, and this depends on the scale of production. Therefore, larger capitals beat smaller ones. So his notion is bigger and bigger firms will be able to produce cheaper and cheaper. They'll undercut the other producers. And so this process will be resulting in larger and larger companies building up over time and eating up the smaller producers as time goes on. A third implication is that the overall economy will be unstable as a result of this process. Now, Marx doesn't spell out, as well as he does some other things, exactly why this instability will occur. But he offers several different ideas. Remember that the conventional wisdom here from David Ricardo is the notion that Say's law means supply equals its own demand. And so over time, you won't get big surpluses or shortages of things. Marx disagrees violently with Say's law. And his way of attacking it is, he starts off by saying, nothing can be more childish than the dogma that because every sale is a purchase and every purchase a sale, therefore the circulation of commodities necessarily implies an equilibrium of sales and purchases. Well, why is that such a childish point of view? He gives an example where he talks about someone who is buying a Bible and selling it for linen, which is really a weird combination of products, I guess. But his point is to emphasize that as this buying and selling goes on, money is involved. And the money can be held out of the system. So there's no guarantee that the buying and selling of things happens simultaneously. Instead, what happens is something is sold, and then there is money held for a time. And then the money is put back into the system to buy something else. So Marx's argument is the system can break down because money can be held out of the system and can break the link between what's being produced and what's being consumed. So he says, think about this metamorphosis of linen, for example. Linen, money, Bible. You sell the linen, you get money, you buy the Bible. The linen first falls out of circulation, and then money steps into its place. Then the Bible falls out of circulation, and again money takes its place. When one commodity replaces another, the money commodity always sticks to the hands of some third person. Circulation sweats money from every pore. The purchaser has the commodity, the seller has the money. No one can sell unless someone else purchases. But no one is bound to purchase because he has just sold. So his notion is people could sell, they could hold on to the money, and if they don't buy something, then supply won't be creating its own demand. And that could cause instability in the economy over time. A second theory is his notion that as the poor and the proletariat become poorer and poorer, pushed by the bourgeoisie, exploited more and more extremely, their buying power will be going down and down. And this is kind of a version of Malthus's argument about gluts. That Malthus argued, look, the rich people won't be consuming enough. Marx said, well, I'm not so worried about the rich people not consuming enough. I'm worried about the poor proletariat not being able to consume enough. There won't be enough buying power in society in that reason. And so it'll be harder and harder to sell products, Marx argued, because there's so many poor people, there's a question of who's going to have enough money to buy them. So, you can see a process here of economic instability going on. Investment happens and wages go up a little bit, but that drives people out of business and companies go bankrupt. And as companies go bankrupt, they put their workers into unemployment and those workers have to struggle to find jobs. A lot of this can be thought of as a technology cycle, a cycle where you invest in new machinery and new technology and that puts people out of work. And that process of more and more machinery, more and more people out of work, capitalists having bigger and bigger and bigger factories, more and more and more machines, and fewer and fewer and fewer people working, is something which will eventually lead to some sort of a crisis if it's maintained. A fourth implication of Marx's point of view, which maybe goes without saying, is just to say there's going to be conflict between the classes here. The bourgeoisie are going to be fighting very, very hard to try and make sure that the proletariat work long hours and work as long as possible. The proletariat are going to be fighting back. So there's clearly going to be arguments going on within society here. But Marx, remember, is not making a political prediction that one side is stronger or weaker. He's making an argument that scientifically, because of these parts of the system, the economy is going to become more and more and more unstable. And eventually, as it ultimately becomes incredibly unstable, the whole structure will begin to come apart. In Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, he has Ebenezer Scrooge say that if poor people are going to die, well then, they might as well go ahead and do it and decrease the surplus population. The surplus population really is the proletariat that Marx is writing about, the people who are tossed out of work and have nowhere to turn or nowhere to go. Where does this end up? Well, the eventual answer is it ends up in the socialist utopia. And one of the most frustrating things about reading Marx, and it is really frustrating, I think, is that he never really tells you how you're going to get to this socialist utopia. There's a lot of good rhetoric, but he never really sort of says how it's going to happen or what it's going to be like. Let me read you from Capital toward the end of the book. He says, as soon as this process of transformation has sufficiently decomposed the old society from top to bottom, as soon as the laborers are turned into proletarians, then the further socialization of labor and further transformation of the land and other means of production into socially exploited and therefore common means of production takes a new form. That which is now to be expropriated is not the laborer working for himself, but the capitalist exploiting many laborers. This expropriation is accomplished by the action of the imminent laws of capitalistic production itself, by the centralization of capital. One capitalist always kills many. So he has some notion here that the capitalists are getting bigger and bigger and bigger, there are fewer and fewer and fewer of them, and there are more and more proletarians. He says, along with the constantly diminishing numbers of the magnates of capital, who usurp and monopolize all advantages of this process of transformation, grows the mass of misery, oppression, slavery, degradation, exploitation. But with this, too, grows the revolt of the working class, a class always increasing in numbers, and disciplined, united, organized by the very mechanism of the process of capitalist production itself. The monopoly of capital becomes a fetter upon the mode of production. Centralization of the means of production and socialization of labor at last reach a point where they become incompatible with their capitalist integument. The integument is burst asunder. The knell of capitalist private property sounds. The expropriators are expropriated. I mean, that's really unsatisfactory, I think. I mean, it's great writing in a way, but, I mean, he just sort of says, well, it at last reaches a point where it's incompatible. Okay. You know, you could ask for a little more guidance. In a way, I think, in a funny way, Marx's notion here is not that different from Mill's notion. I think his notion somehow, as he lays out in some of his other writings, about this end state, this stationary state, this utopia, is that the capitalists will be producing so much at that point that you can just sort of distribute it all to people. And you won't have to worry about expanding production. Because after all, everyone will have enough of everything. And that somehow we will have reached a point where capitalism is so powerful and so forceful that it just allows that kind of transition to happen. But I honestly think that it's just very hard in reading Marx to come up with a clear idea of how this is supposed to be happening, or how this utopia would be governed, or what it means to say, well, okay, the expropriators are expropriated, but, you know, where does that take you? It's just really not very clear. Let me talk about Marxist economics now with 2020 hindsight and how we look back at the subject. I should emphasize this is not a fair way of judging Marx or of judging anyone, because people at the time are writing about things, you know, from a different place than we are now. Nonetheless, I think it's important to try and sort out what ideas from Marxism are especially helpful to modern economists and which ones are less helpful. Let's first of all just talk about some of these specific scientific predictions and what's become of them. Well, most obviously, the proletariat has not become isolated and immiserated, and we haven't had a vast overthrow by workers who were impoverished. Now, of course, there are still poor people. Of course, we still have income inequality. Of course, in many parts of the world, that inequality has been increasing in the last 20 years. I'm not denying those points. But Marx is not talking about a little bit of inequality. He is talking about vast numbers of people pushed into crushing poverty, without any sort of jobs, dying young, being trapped in these terrible factories. And you just cannot look at the modern world of capitalism and say, well, that's where we ended up. I mean, that's just not where things have gone. Moreover, his notion that technology would reduce the number of jobs is clearly not quite right either. After all, there's been a lot of technological development since about 1850, an enormous number of new inventions. If it was true that inventions got rid of jobs, we should be down to about 15 jobs in the whole economy at this point. But we still sort of keep trucking along with about 5% unemployment, 8% unemployment, and Marx's prediction of this vast army of unemployed people, a vast proletariat trying to get jobs, really just doesn't seem to have come about. Let's talk particularly about the labor theory of value and why it's not really thought of as very helpful these days. First of all, is it really true that no one else contributes? Is it really true that that's it, the labor theory of value? After all, what about management? What about capital? What about entrepreneurs? What about somebody who saves up to open a little shop or something like that? Can you really reasonably say that it's all labor and it's all those current workers? I think, you know, it's pretty reasonable that you can't say that. You can say that workers contributed the lion's share or something like that, but Marx isn't talking about the lion's share. He wants the workers to have every single bit of it. Any modern person, any modern worker knows the difference between a good manager and a lousy manager makes a huge difference. The difference between good equipment and bad equipment makes a huge difference. And you can't see those kinds of differences and say, well, all value just comes from the labor of the workers that are there. Second difficulty in terms of the labor theory of value. Doesn't demand have some role to play in all this? I mean, imagine two people. One person works a long, long time in their backyard making a large sculpture out of straws or something like that that no one wants to buy, and the other person works in a factory producing something people do want to buy. If labor is the source of value, then why is it that these one thing has value and one thing doesn't have value? Well, the obvious answer is people want to buy one and they don't want to buy the other one. But you have to bring in demand, not just labor. Third, his labor theory of value implies that over and over, people are going to be pushed down. Their wages are going to be dropped lower and lower and lower. But won't the market raise people's wages to some extent? After all, if you've got competing employers, and you've got one worker at another company who's really, really, really good, and they're not being paid very much, isn't someone else going to come along and offer them a higher wage? If they don't, can't they go out on their own and start up their own company or something like that? If you've got competitive labor markets hiring different people, it's hard to see how they won't drive up the wage over time, rather than having it drop and drop and drop and drop. Also, this question of what is a worker worth and how is the wage determined is a really tricky one. After all, think about the situation where you say, I think I'm worth a lot more than my employer pays me. So, are you going to quit your job? If you're worth so much more, why don't you just quit and go do it on your own and be an independent consultant? Well, the answer is probably, well, you know, if I were independent, if I weren't in this company, I wouldn't get paid so much. Maybe I wouldn't be able to do exactly what I'm doing because I need the rest of this company around me to be a productive person. But if that's true, if you need the rest of the company and the organization around you, then it becomes difficult to say, all my labor is my value and what I'm worth. Because what you're worth only has meaning in the context of this whole organization coming together somehow. It only has meaning in the context of everyone working on different sets of things. And so, when you think about what is a fair wage for workers, I don't mean to say that workers don't deserve more money. I think often they do. I don't mean to say that wages work perfectly or markets work perfectly. I don't think they do. But I think that if you consider a modern worker, think about someone who, say, has worked on the United Auto Workers assembly line in Detroit for the last 30 or 40 years and is now getting close to retirement. It seems to me extremely difficult to look at that worker and say to yourself, this person is a brutally exploited proletarian. I mean, if they've been on the UAW team for a while, they're making a good, decent salary. They've got health benefits. They've got retirement benefits. They probably have a boat and a lake house somewhere. It's not something where this notion of exploitation, much as it touches your gut somehow, works very well. And that's not to say they don't deserve 10% more or 20% more. It's just to say that the sense that they are brutally exploited, down to the point of poverty, just doesn't hold up very well. What are some other difficulties with the Marxist point of view? Remember, Marx was predicting that the rate of profit would fall over time, because after all, there'd be more capital and fewer workers to exploit in every factory. Well, the rate of profit doesn't seem to fall a lot over time, so that prediction has not really been borne out very well. Marx predicted that the scale of plants would constantly be increasing, and they'd be getting larger and larger. Is that true? Well, for about 50 years after Marx wrote, that was actually a pretty good prediction. Because during the later 19th century and early 20th century, you see enormous companies being built, Standard Oil, giant railroads, things like that. And so the notion of the larger scale really made sense in that context. But if you look at the last 50 years, you don't see that big companies are taking over the U.S. economy, for example. If anything, if you look at, say, the Fortune 500 or something like that, that actually has a smaller share of the U.S. economy and a smaller share of U.S. employment than it did 25 or 30 years ago. So this notion that bigness was a trend that would never stop seems to be not quite right. And what about economic instability? Certainly, if you think about the disruptions of the 19th century and stuff during the Great Depression, Marx's predictions of instability looked pretty good. But again, remember, he's not just talking about something like the economy will have a recession now and then. He's talking about giant, systematic crises which will drive millions and millions of people out of work. The Great Depression would qualify as a Marxist-type problem. But, you know, we haven't had a Great Depression for 60 years. We've only had one in the time since Marx wrote. The notion that capitalism is doomed to that kind of thing, it doesn't seem to hold up extremely well. Marx didn't really have a very good political sense. He wouldn't have believed, I don't think, that the political system would allow the workers to pass things like Social Security and unemployment protection and welfare benefits and all those different kinds of laws. John Stuart Mill would have been perfectly happy with this. Mill would have said, separate production and distribution. Pass some laws about distribution if that's a problem. But Marx's political thinking seems to me extraordinarily rudimentary. He just sort of had this sense it would all be incompatible, the exploiters would now be expropriated, and things would change. But the dynamic through which that happened, the notion of the modern welfare state, is clearly not something that he considered as very possible. And finally, at a gut level, I think it's fair to say that Marx just didn't have the understanding of markets that someone like Smith or Mill had. I don't mean to say something strong here, like he was ignorant of arguments about the market. That's silly. I mean, Marx was an extraordinarily well-read man, fully familiar with all of these different arguments. What I'm really saying is, if I say someone doesn't know quite as much about markets as Adam Smith or John Stuart Mill, that's kind of like saying there's not a whole lot of people who can run a mile in less than 4 minutes. We're talking a fairly lofty level of competition here when we talk about understanding markets at that level. But Marx really, you become sort of, as an economist, you keep asking certain questions, like, why doesn't Marx see that markets can adjust to raise wages over time? Why doesn't he see how a labor market might cause someone to pay higher wages? Why doesn't he see how new companies can come along and challenge old companies and break them up sometimes or defeat them? You know, why does that subject never come up? Marx clearly doesn't understand how an economy generates new jobs. His notion really seemed to be, hey, once you've been replaced by a machine, that's it. You know, you're really poor, you're on the breadline, there's nothing else you can do. There's no way to climb back. The number of good jobs is just dropping and dropping and dropping, and that's how it is. And that sense that an economy, through the division of labor, keeps creating new opportunities for people to barter and truck with each other, that Adam Smith described, really just doesn't show up. He fails to understand that employers often like to treat workers better. Because after all, in a modern information economy, if you don't treat workers well, they're very likely to leave you and do something else. But that notion that often you would want to treat workers well because you would get more productivity out of them is an idea that Marx really doesn't ever talk about. Marx's language just drips with doubts that markets can work, over and over and over. And he never quite says they don't work, but it seems to be, if I had to summarize his view, that there's just too big a chance that markets are going to break down. And they're just not likely to work well. And sooner or later, we're really doomed to collapse here. If I were to try and sum up Marxist economics, I guess the thought I'd like to leave you with is something like this. I believe that whenever you're going to think like an economist, it's important to separate out social concern and economic analysis. And in fact, Marx would have been the first one to say it's extremely important to separate these two things. A lot of people sort of have a sympathetic appeal for Marx. They like Marx because Marx stuck up for the ordinary guy. Marx wrote about these terrible conditions of working people. Marx was on the side of the working man. Marx wanted the working man to have a better deal than he had had before. But you know, if you had gone to Karl Marx himself and you would have said, "Karl, you know, I'm glad you're on our side," Karl would have spit at you. Karl was not a sympathy guy. Karl wanted to argue that this is scientific. This is not a matter of sympathy. This is not a matter of soft-heartedness. This is just a matter of science and what happens. And I think it is patronizing to say to Karl Marx, "Well, your heart was in the right place." You know, he wanted to be judged as a scientific thinker, and I think that's the right way to try and judge him. And as a scientific thinker, he built his theories on bad footings. As a scientific thinker, he bought into the labor theory of value just after people like John Stuart Mill had persuasively argued that you should think about it in supply and demand terms instead. It's also true that his economic analysis, broadly speaking, while it held up fairly well for 20 or 30 or 40 years, which is a long time, when you look at it from the modern world, you just don't see the dynamic that he predicted coming into play across a broad range of areas. And so if you're going to judge him scientifically, as Marx would want to be judged, you would have to say, look, Marx, you know, he didn't get it right. That's all there is to it. He just didn't get it right. He made a reasonable set of predictions based on the evidence at the time, but if we're judging scientifically, that's not correct. On the other hand, that's in some sense the wrong way to judge Marx, even though it's the standard he set for himself. Marx's economics is full of warts and flaws and things that don't quite work out, but he was a brilliant thinker, and a humane thinker, I believe, and somewhat inspiring. He was part historian, part sociologist, part polemicist. It's been said he was part prophet, and I think all those things are somewhat true as well. He still touches our guts and our heart in some sort of unique ways that I think none of these other thinkers do. So let me ask you, have you ever really been worried that maybe big companies are getting bigger and bigger and are likely to take over the economy or take over large parts of it? Have you ever wondered about whether capitalism was just unstable and likely to fall apart? Have you ever felt in your gut that a lot of workers are just not getting paid fairly for what they contribute? Have you ever believed that there'll be a time when the common people will finally reach up, rip down these people who have been up top for so long, tear down the structures of power, and build a more just society, that has to happen sooner or later? If you've ever had any of those feelings, you've felt the pull of Marxist thinking. Those are all ideas which Marx articulated as well or better than anyone before or since. Marx set the intellectual agenda for thinking about social science for nearly a century. He posed the idea of this capitalism, this laissez-faire capitalism, against a system that he had designed and set up and thought through in enormous detail. That setting the intellectual agenda for more than a century is an extraordinarily powerful legacy to leave behind. It's really rivaled in a way only by that of Adam Smith.